This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Russ George, the one-man geoengineering phenomenon, strikes again. And despite an ocean dumping and geoengineering ban by 192 countries, George has help from Canada and the U.S. This time, the green-talking former CEO of Planktos Corp. didn't just dump some red paint off the back of Neil Young's yacht, as he did in 2002. George has secretly added 100 tons of iron sulfate to the ocean off Canada's west coast to create an algae bloom. In 2007, Radio EcoShock did a one-hour interview with Russ George, followed by a second-hole program with his critics, including Pat Mooney of the ETC Group. Interest is huge. The Pat Mooney interview has been downloaded at least 20,000 times. After Planktos went down in flames amid accusations of shady promoters from Vancouver and stock manipulation, Russ George faded from the public eye, but he never stopped dreaming he could help stop climate change or make money using ocean life. George wants to make that money by seeding the world's oceans with iron to stimulate algae growth. Now the ETC Group has revealed his latest plot. It was first published in The Guardian and picked up by Canadian newspapers. Is it covert geoengineering or rogue geoengineering? Jim Thomas joins us from the International Environmental Watchdog Agency, the ETC Group, or the Etc. Group. Welcome, Jim.
Hello.
Well, despite all the international outcry, Russ George manages to try geoengineering again, and we only find out about it a couple of months later. How did your group discover it?
Well, as you know, we've been monitoring geoengineering for some time, and we've also been involved in the negotiations at the Convention on Biological Diversity, which are at this moment going on in India, trying to put a ban on geoengineering experiments. And at the edges of that meeting, we began to hear rumors that this had happened, this ocean fertilization dump. So we investigated it, and it turned out to be true.
And so what do we know?
Well, what we know is that Russ George, who was formerly from Planktos, has convinced a community in Haida Gwaii off the coast of British Columbia, Canada, to give him a large amount of money to go out into the ocean and dump iron into the ocean. That he claims that he's dumped 100 tons into the ocean 200 nautical miles west of Haida Gwaii, and that that's created a 10,000 square kilometer plankton bloom. And that happened in July of this year. That's what he claims, and there certainly is a large plankton bloom. So it may be true.
Do we know the name of his ship?
His ship was called the Ocean Pearl. It was a fishing vessel that he rented. And his company, the shell company that he's using now, is called the Haida Salmon Restoration Corporation.
It's just amazing that somebody could sneak 100 tons, if that's what he really did, up the coast, and nobody talks about it? A multi-million dollar project, perhaps? How could this happen?
Well, it seems that Russ George and his collaborator, a guy called John Disney, who is the economic development officer for this particular village, sold this to the people of the village as a salmon restoration project. And they told them that if they dumped iron into the ocean, there would be a bloom, and the bloom would be for bringing back the salmon. And the loss of salmon on the West Coast here in Canada is a really big issue for Indigenous communities. And so that was compelling. They thought, let's try.
So he perhaps didn't use his old argument of we're going to stop climate change by getting the algae to soak up the carbon dioxide, or was that involved as well? Do we know?
Well, it seems that was involved as well. There's documents from the business plan that suggest that he promised the community they would be making money from carbon credits. From this bloom, and indeed his collaborator John Disney has told the press, as soon as we've got the information verified, we're going to start getting the carbon credits. So there was a promise that there would be money coming from carbon credits from sequestration, quite where he thought he was going to get somebody to give him carbon credits for ocean fertilization, given that it's effectively banned, or at least under very strong moratoria, is beyond me.
So really, he's up to his old games. I mean, this is what he was doing before. He was promising carbon credits for really what is an unverifiable process and selling them as a private company. It doesn't sound like he's changed much.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't sound like it. And what's particularly sad about this is, once again, the victims in this are a rather poor community who have been misled.
And where was the Canadian government? Isn't there a way to spot ocean dumping with the Coast Guard or satellite monitoring or something?
Well, that's the question right now, is how much did the Canadian government know about this beforehand? And did they try and stop it, or did they let it happen? The Canadian government has been remarkably vague and evasive when asked questions about what they knew. They say they've launched a probe and an investigation, so they're not talking. The people involved, both Russ George and his collaborator in the Haida Salmon Restoration Corporation, say that they did know that they were in fact working with the Canadian government, and that the National Research Council of Canada were involved. And certainly Canada is very much on the hook for this at the Convention on Biological Diversity and at the London Convention, because it is a Canadian ship. It left probably from a Canadian port. It certainly had Canadian scientists on board. And it was Canada that should have overseen this and prevented it from happening.
And it's possible that he does have scientists on board to verify this. Do we know who any of them might be?
Well, we do and we don't. Russ George himself was listed as the chief scientist of the HSRC. He's been very quiet in mentioning who the other scientists are, but if you look on the internet, you can find out that mostly they're recent graduates of universities in Canada. His senior scientist is a senior ocean scientist, seems to be a bachelor of science in chemistry and computer modeling. They don't seem to be very senior scientists at all.
Well, as far as I could find out, Russ George has a 4-year degree. He doesn't have any particular expertise in oceanography or algae or biology or zoology. How can he claim to be the senior scientist?
Well, Russ George has claimed to be all sorts of things throughout the years, whether it's in cold fusion or selling carbon credits to the Vatican. He's a man who seems to have a particular gift for convincing people of things. And unfortunately, that seems to be what he's done here.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm speaking with Jim Thomas of the ETC Group, which has been monitoring geoengineering around the world. Now, Russ George, the former CEO of Planktos, has taken matters into his own hands, creating an unnatural algae bloom off Canada's west coast, we think. Well, Jim, what are the risks of experimenting with ocean life?
The reason why there is a moratorium on ocean fertilization experiments is because there's a set of questions that have been raised about what could happen to the ocean. And some of the concerns range from the potential when you create an unnatural bloom, which this would be, that you could favor the growth of harmful algal species, so species that could produce types of acid that could hurt seabirds and other wildlife, or the sort of red tides that we see in the Gulf of Mexico. That's one worry. Concerns that you would get a depletion of oxygen in the lower waters, and so that, again, would affect wildlife and the marine environment, that you could get some of the species outside the patch get reduced as a result of the ocean fertilization. And also that rather than sequestering carbon dioxide, which so far there doesn't seem to be much evidence that unnatural blooms are able to sequester CO2, instead you may get the production of other harmful greenhouse gases like methane and nitrous oxide. So these are some of the concerns that led 192 nations of the world to put in place a moratorium, first on ocean fertilization and then later on geoengineering more broadly. Because of course, there are bigger ethical issues at play.
And Russ George, meanwhile, he claims he's collaborating with the U.S. National Ocean and Atmospheric Administration, but he's been so loose in the past with such endorsement and claims. What are your thoughts?
Well, it's true that he has got a lot of very expensive, sophisticated equipment on this trip. And he claims that, for example, 20 ocean-going bots, buoys, have been given to him by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in the U.S., and that they're collaborating. They may well have been given to him by NOAA. He also claims to have got some very sophisticated gliders, what are called sea gliders, from a Canadian outfit. He claims that NASA has been giving them training. So it's a really interesting question. Why is a U.S. federal agency giving very expensive equipment to this illegal dump?
And meanwhile, they go to meetings around the world and sign on to things saying that we shouldn't be doing this. So there's kind of covertly doing it. I think this is something new. It's covert geoengineering.
Well, I mean, certainly what's happening here with Russ George is rogue geoengineering. But certainly there's a worry that what we're seeing in the last few years is an increasing interest from the Canadian government, the U.S. government, the U.K. government, those three governments in particular, to allow a certain level of geoengineering testing, to move towards some sort of deployment of geoengineering experiments And so, yes, it begins to raise questions when you see a supposedly rogue experiment of this size that Canada just didn't happen to see and the U.S. federal agency seems to be involved with. I'm not saying there's a conspiracy here, but I think these countries need to account very quickly for what's happened.
And I understand there are, as you mentioned, ongoing meetings and conferences about geoengineering and international law. Is there a way to control rogue experimenters like Russ George?
One of the things that is being discussed right now at the UN Convention on Biological Diversity, which is meeting right now in India, in Hyderabad, is how do we put in place enforcement mechanisms? And then this just shows that up extremely well. How do we make sure that countries are checking that geoengineering experiments aren't going ahead or that experiments are not crossing the line to being geoengineering experiments? So we need to put that in place.
And that's one of my biggest fears about geoengineering. If a single country could just start pumping sulfur into the atmosphere, all of our atmosphere, or even launch a rocket full of mirrors out to block the sun, and now we see just a small scientific lab or even a member of the public could start their own show. It's like a free-for-all, and it could get more desperate as the climate deteriorates. Should we be frightened by the example Russ George sets?
Well, I think this is exactly why the international community, the countries who are meeting at the CBD and through the London Convention, have to give a very, very strong signal that geoengineering is not acceptable. It is not the correct way to address the climate crisis. It is extremely risky. It's inequitable. And that this is, you know, this is something that should be forbidden. That has to come very clearly from our world leaders. And instead, what we see is a number of countries, or particularly a small group of very powerful countries, who would like to go the other way. They'd like to see messages getting out there that maybe we should have geoengineering, maybe it should be part of the mix. And that will take apart existing commitments to try and address climate change through sensible means, and it will open the doors to these sort of rogue experiments.
Jim Thomas, is there anything else you would like to tell us as this story develops?
I think the question is going to be, can the world say this is the wrong direction to go and use this as an opportunity to put in place a strong, meaningful ban on experiments, geoengineering experiments, because we're going to see more of these. We're going to see experiments in the U.S. possibly later this year for putting sulfates in the atmosphere. We're going to see other proposals moving ahead to try and whiten clouds. As we hear more of these, we need to have a much clearer global position.
From Montreal, Canada, we've been talking with Jim Thomas of the Etc. Group. Find them at etcgroup.org. Jim, I know you've had media calls from all over the world. Thank you for making time for Radio EcoShock listeners.
You're very welcome.
You can find links to my in-depth coverage of ocean geoengineering in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Look for the posting October 17th, 2012. You'll find a one-hour interview with Russ George, where I confront him about claims made but never fulfilled. Plus a program with three guests who out the man, his questionable promotion of cold fusion, and his ban from trading man behind the scenes, Canada's Nelson Skalbania. My guests in that 2007 program are Dr. David Santillo, the Greenpeace scientist, Pat Mooney from the ETC Group, and Vancouver Sun business investigator David Baines. It's a tale of intrigue and misrepresentation that may have happened again, this time to a prominent First Nation in Canada. Get all that, plus all interviews and speeches from today's show, as free MP3s in my blog at ecoshock.info or from our website at ecoshock.org. This is shocking behavior by Canada and the United States, both of whom agreed to the ocean fertilization ban and limits on geoengineering. It's a disappointment from a respected West Coast tribe, the Haida, who have been environmentally progressive. Did they not look up George's record as a promoter who does not deliver? I'm not disappointed in Russ George. Everybody expected this driven man to try and try again. He thinks he's right where everybody else is wrong. He's a kind of ocean outlaw. The publicity and the millions raised for each project as the would-be doctor or senior scientist sails again, well, that's just gravy for him. Russ George is a one-man ocean wrecking ball and the poster child for why we need ocean enforcement and a real moratorium on geoengineering. Stay tuned for another industrial crime. Indigenous women in Canada are raising their voices against the polluting tar sands and the pipeline releasing their poisons to the world. Who cares about another pipeline in northern Canada? When it threatens to pump dirty tar sands oil to China and the world, everyone needs to know. Those who know best are the native people living close to the biggest source of industrial pollution on the planet, and those depending on the thousand streams risking poison from the Northern Gateway Pipeline, from Alberta through British Columbia to the pristine Great Bear Rainforest and the coast. First Nations women are taking the lead in speaking up for their communities and the future. If the tar sands power Asia and America, climate catastrophe is assured. We can't let that happen. Now you will hear First Nations speakers recorded September 21st in Vancouver. A UK activist also reports on the international campaign to stop tar sands madness. I'm Alex Smith. There's not much more I can say. Our future and our children are at stake, you know that.
Next up, I'm delighted to invite up Ariel Duranger. Ariel is a Dene from the Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation of Northern Alberta. She's currently the communications coordinator for the Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation, who have recently filed a suit against oil giant Shell Oil Canada. And Ariel comes from a fierce family, including her mom, Suzanne Duranger, who many of us know. So thank you again, Ariel.
Thank you. Merci Chiro.
First off, I just want to say thank you for everyone that put on this event, and thank you for Melina speaking and giving the context to what the tar sands really is and just how big the tentacles and the beast that tar sands really is and how far it stretches and what it can and does do to many, many Indigenous communities within its path. My community, the Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation, we are Dene people. We belong to the Athabasca region in northern Alberta. Our people extend into the Northwest Territories. The Dene people are strong people. Woo! We have lineage. Our lineage goes all the way to Alaska, and our cousins, the Navajo, or the Dene down south. So we are a strong line of people, and we are people with strong women. My grandmother was the backbone of our family. She had 19 children, and she raised them all. She taught them about the land. My grandfather was a trapper. My mother is a strong warrior woman who taught me how to stand up for my rights. And it's the women that hold our communities together and prop our people up. So just to give you a little bit of context, Indigenous people and the Athabasca tar sands. Indigenous people have a strong culture that's intertwined with nature, with the wilderness around us, with the animals, with the water, with the air, with the grandmother moon, the grandfather sun, Mother Earth. We are interconnected with all of it. We depend on it. It is us and we are them. And then we have the tar sands. The tar sands is counterintuitive to who we are as Indigenous people. It destroys the land, it poisons the air, it poisons the water, it kills the animals. It is counterproductive to who we are as Indigenous people. We are at odds with something so close to where we are. If you look at this picture at the bottom, on one side you see our traditional territory still intact. And that picture really depicts the struggle that our people are really in, because on the opposite side we see full-scale development. Those bodies of water that are in little squares, that's toxic tailing. That river system that goes through, that river system is the Athabasca River. That is the heart of our community. That is the life of our community. Our people rely on it. And that destruction is right there beside it. Those tailings ponds are leaching into that river system and ultimately killing our community. So just to give you context of where my community is in correlation to this development, we have down here at the very bottom, that picture you saw, you can see it from outer space. The tailings ponds are so big. That little blotch, it's actually quite a bit bigger because I think this picture is from 2006. I think now it's probably double that size. That line going through is the Athabasca River, the heart of our community. And if you keep going up, the community of Fort Chipewyan is where the people of the Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation live, along with the Miccosukee Cree Nation, a Métis settlement, and a non-Indigenous settlement. And we sit in the mouth of Lake Athabasca, which is the heart of our communities. Fort Chipewyan is a fly-in-only community, or you can take the river system, which is getting harder and harder to navigate because of how much water they're using for the production of tar sands. So our community is small, about 1,100, 1,000 people, and what happens in our community and what happens to the individuals of the community affects all of us. So our people, like I said, it's a quite diversity of people in the community. We rely on the plants and the medicines that are found in and around our community. Everyone there knows where you can pick berries, where you can find the medicines, where you dig the rat root, where you pick the berries in the springtime, the best places to go fishing. Most of these people are trappers, hunters, fishermen. And the culture and the identity of who they are still thrives in the community. They don't even see it as culture and identity. They see it as just living and being who you are. Until 20 years ago, some people say it's as early as 15 years ago, the community was 80% subsistence, meaning the food that they put on the table, the way that they survived was from the land, because we are the land. As Dene Sulin people, we say that we are the land. This is Indian land. That's what we say. When the industry comes up there, we say, this isn't your land. This isn't government's land. This is our land. This is our traditional territory. If you want to do something up here in our land, you need to consult with us and you need to get our permission. You know, Clayton, my good friend Clayton Thomas Mueller once said, going up in Fort Chip, it really is like God's country, because it is. It's so beautiful. You can't imagine anything more beautiful than what it's like up there. I might have to argue with some of you guys that live in BC. It's beautiful here. But being in an isolated northern community is absolutely incredible. The culture there is strong. Like I said, we don't see it as like something different. If you ask people, what's the cultural identity like up here? They're like, what do you mean? Because they don't see it as a separate entity from who we are. So Canada's tar sands. It's the third largest oil deposits after Saudi Arabia. And right now the surface mining is what dominates my people's traditional territory and accounts for about 20% of the oil that currently covers about 550 square kilometers. Currently, there are over 30 companies that are active in the tar sands. This is what an in-situ pad looks like, something the Alberta government calls innocuous or environmentally. It has entirely benign environmental impacts. This is the open pit mines. Keep in mind, this is all within my people's traditional territory, the territories that we have used for thousands of years to sustain our people. And so, Shell. Who is Shell? Shell is one of the largest operators in the tar sands right now. They currently have they have about 5 different projects in the Athabasca region, and they also have projects in Molina in the Peace River region. They also have projects in Crystal from the Beaver Lake in the Cold Lake region. They are one of the huge conglomerates, and they feel as though they can do no wrong, because how could they? They also have international projects. They are one of the largest oil and gas companies in the world, and I've had the opportunity to go and speak to shareholders in other countries. And so just to give you an idea, so they have a joint project that Shell 60% own, and they currently are producing about 255,000 barrels per day, and they want to propose 2 new projects. These 2 new projects, the Jackpine Mine expansion, is currently right on top of our traditional territories and would produce an additional 100,000. And the Pierre River mine would be 27 kilometers from the perimeter of our reserve. So ACFN, or Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation, you know, we finally said enough is enough. We have hundreds of applications coming before our community saying, here, look at this proposal, look at this proposal. Tell us what you think, but you only have a deadline of 30 days. And if you don't get back to us in 30 days, you're basically giving us your consent. That's exactly how consultation happens in Alberta. So what happens? Our people get bullied into deals because the projects, the bulldozers are moving, the applications are through, government says, oh, they told you about it. So our people take what are called impact benefit agreements. They're basically piecemeal offerings from industry and from government to try and appease us. And our past leadership made impact benefit agreements with Shell for 2 of their current operations to try and compensate us for our losses. And part of that is we said, okay, you want to compensate us for our losses? We want a place at the table with you. We want to know exactly what you're doing, how you're doing it. We want to build your mitigation. We want to build your environmental standards. And they said, okay, but guess what? Shell has reneged on their responsibilities and they haven't lived up to that agreement. So we said, okay, that's how you want to play? We're going to sue you. So what are we doing? We're drawing a line in the tar sands or in the sand. And we're taking a strong stand now. We're saying enough is enough. There's too much rapid development in our traditional territory, and we can't survive without our land. We're saying our treaty rights, our rights to the land, our rights to our culture and our identity as who we are, our constitutionally protected rights take paramount over economic development. ACFN wants no further development by Shell or any other industry until the broader impacts of development and how they affect our rights. How they're going to actually ever mitigate them. Will they ever be able to mitigate them? Because current practices look at the environmental standards as if it's a separate entity. But as Indigenous people, as Dene Sulin people, we are not separate from them. So how can you measure that? How can industry and government come in and say, well, we've decided that in order to mitigate this project, we need to build you a compensation lake. I'm not even joking about this, guys. They have said to us, we're going to mitigate our practices because, yes, granted, we're going to take a bunch of water. We're going to destroy some fishing beds and some traditional territory along the Athabasca River. But don't worry. We're going to take a bunch of water from the Athabasca River, which you use as a navigable river system. We're going to put it into a big hole, and we're going to call it Compensation Lake so you guys can still have your fishing rights. I'm not even joking. This isn't the first time they've tried it. This is the second time. The first time, it failed. And they somehow think that they're going to propose it again, and that's going to appease us. The whole point is right now, Alberta, industry, they don't know how to even look at our rights. They don't understand our rights. They don't understand what it means to have treaty and cultural rights. What is traditional ecological knowledge? How do we utilize it? How do we move forward? How do we protect it? And they're doing nothing to address it. They say, okay, well, why don't you just tell us what it is? And we say, we can tell you. But how are you going to address it? How are you going to fix it? How are you going to ensure that this isn't going to continue to happen? And they say, well, if you just tell us, we'll do it. Our people are saying, no. You want to fix it? You want to address it? You need to sit down at the table. You need to learn what it means to be Indigenous. You need to understand traditional ecological knowledge. You need to get back to where we come from. So, we've sued Shell. They have these two new projects, the Jack Pine Mine and the Pear River. And the Jack Pine Mine is coming up. It's coming up next month, end of October. It'll happen in Fort McMurray. Starting on October 23rd, ACFN is going to put forward, for the very first time, a constitutional challenge to try and halt the approval of an application in the tar sands. We're gonna basically fight them tooth and nail. We're going to say, sorry, government. Sorry, industry. Enough is enough. The status quo of the approval rates has to stop. You can no longer do this piecemeal pity consultation with our people. You need to understand who we are. We need to be sitting down with you side by side because we are nations. And we have nation-to-nation agreements with the government. And you need to respect who we are. And until such time, it's not going to happen. So, how does that come back to BC? I know I've got like probably 1 minute left. If we continue to allow the expansion and the development in the tar sands, they are going to come up with different routes and different ways to get it to the coast of BC, to the coast of the Arctic, to wherever they need to go. If we don't stop the expansion at the very heart of where it is, where my people come from, and I'm telling you, it hasn't been an easy battle. My people suffer. We have cancers, some of the highest rates of cancers in Alberta, 30% higher than the rest of the province. We have autoimmune diseases. We have elevating rates of diabetes because our ability to practice our traditional diets has been basically taken away from us. Our people are dying. My cousin calls it slow industrial genocide is happening to our people. And we have to stop it. But in order to stop it, we need you on this side stopping the pipelines. But we need you to support us stopping the expansion in the heart of the tar sands. And you can. So please, like, you have the ability until October 1st, you can send a letter to Shell and to the JRP, the Joint Review Panel, reviewing Shell's application, at thestopshellnow.com, and you can just do it right online, and you can just say, you know, hell no, shell, go to hell, whatever you want to say. Or you can say, I stand with the Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation. You need to do proper consultation with First Nations. We want to inundate them with as many comments and supporters from across the country, from across Turtle Island, from across Mother Earth. So please, I implore you all to stand with our people as we take on one of the largest multinational oil companies in the world. Masi Chiro.
That was Ariel Desranger, Communications Director of the Athabasca Chipewyan First Nations, neighbors and victims to the monstrous tar sands operations in the north of Alberta, Canada. She was recorded at the event She Speaks, Indigenous Women Speak Out Against the Tar Sands, recorded in Vancouver on September 21st by the Red Eye Collective at CFRO Co-op Radio. This is Radio EcoShock with a special on the Canadian tar sands and the fight against the Northern Gateway Pipeline proposal that endangers the northern wilderness and the Wild West Coast. Coming up, a report on tar sands resistance in the United Kingdom and child activist and singer Takaya Blaney. First, Frida Hewson of the Wet'suwet'en Nation about a resistance camp built to protect the land from the Northern Gateway Pipeline.
Frida is the spokesperson of the Unist'ot'en clan of the Wet'suwet'en Nation, who oppose all pipelines and all mining projects in their territory. The Unist'ot'en have built a resistance camp to protect the land from the Northern Gateway, the Kitimat Summit Lake Looping Project, Pacific Trails Pipeline, Pembina, and Kinder Morgan proposed pipelines. Everyone, please, an incredibly warm welcome to Frida.
First of all, I just like the territory holders of this territory I'm standing on. I just thank you for welcoming me on your territory. To me, this is like really personal. The reason why I do this is I grew up on my territory. My grandma taught my mom. My great-grandmother lived to be 113 years old, and she lived off the land, outlived all her children. So she taught her grandchildren how to take care of the land, how to live off the land. And said it was for important to them to teach us. And my mom has taught me how to live off the land. I didn't see PNE. When we went for summer holidays, all the kids would come back with their stories. When a teacher would ask, what did you do for your summer holidays? You'd hear PNE, went to Edmonton. And when it came to me, I would be talking about the territories. I went fishing. I went hunting. I went picking berries. That was my summer holidays, and I'm so thankful for it. Because if I didn't have those summer holidays, I wouldn't be standing here saying we're defending our lands. I come from the Hunastat'en people. You probably hear that a lot in the media because you say it's the Hunastat'en that are fighting industry. They call us the people of the headwaters because we protect the headwaters, the very headwaters that are being impacted by industry now. It's the Buckley and the Skeena River. Like the Morris River flows into the Buckley and then into the Skeena. The grandma I was talking about had the name Nedibis, which now my uncle holds. My uncle Warner, he heeded my grandma's words and constructed two trapline cabins on the shore of Morris River. And it was shamelessly burned to the ground by Canfor Logging Company. Our lessons learned. It's a snapshot of the Hunastat'en's Yinta. It's our territories, taken only a few years ago. Take note of the extremely high degree of deforestation. You see all the bald spots? Those are clear cut. That impacts our ability to go pick berries, hunt, pick our traditional medicines. And just recently, we drove, and for 36 kilometers, it's all clear cut. And coincidentally, it's in a route of the pipeline. Time for change. It's awakening for my clan. On October 5th, 2009, we attended an all-clans gathering in my community. Five clans of the Wet'suwet'en Nation unanimously opted out of the BC Treaty process. A decision was made to begin asserting our rights. rights we've never given up. We've never ceded or surrendered our land, and it's our responsibility to take care of that land. From that meeting, my clan designated me as their spokesperson to deal with industry, anybody coming onto our lands. I'm responsible to relay the message back to my chiefs and my membership on what industry is proposing and relaying the message back on what my chiefs and membership say. Whether it's no, and most of the time it is no, we don't agree to any industry. It's a new beginning. Accountability, responsibility, and respect for our lands. On March 29th in 2010, we sent out a media release informing public, government, and industry. Unistaten is a sovereign and independent of the Office of Wet'suwet'en. OW is no longer has 22,000 kilometers to negotiate. After we declared that in the spring, myself and Togastai, my fiancé, were going out to check on one of our territories. It's called Poplar Lake, Takatothland. We had the snowmobile in the back of our truck. We thought we were going to come in, park the truck and snowmobile into the rest of the way into the cabin. But when we came to the spot where we were supposed to snowmobile in, the road was plowed. So I looked over and I said, what's going on here? Somebody's in here. And he looked right away and said, mining. So we drove all the way into my cabin, and when we reached the cabin site, we just said, we'll leave the truck right on the road, so whoever's in there is going to have to honk when they come back out. Sure enough, the next morning, heard a horn honking, so we got up and just went quickly to the road, asked the gentleman that got out of the truck and come over. I asked, who are you and what are you doing here? And he said he came from, he was working for an exploration company, and he's the owner of a company that's setting up a camp. And I just said, you never spoke to my clan. I've never heard of you. You guys don't have any business in here. It's considered trespass. So we let him leave. I took his card and let him go. And he said he still had people back at where they were setting up the camp. So after he left, Togastai and I drove over to the site where they were trying to set up the camp. And I went over and spoke to those two workers that had left there and said the exact same thing to him, that they didn't have permission to be there, that they shouldn't be there. And just before I left, I told those workers, everything you have here, you're trespassing, you don't have our permission to be here. So if you don't have everything out of here by Friday 12 noon, everything you have here belongs to my clan. So after we left there, I decided I needed to go home right away and report to my chiefs what we came upon. And they thought it was important that they wanted to go out and see it for themselves. So they all went out, checked for themselves, and said the exact same thing as I told them, that they had to be out of there by Friday. And as you see, there was mostly women. It was women and children that did the blockade, because we blocked the road. Went to make sure no other equipment or anything else went in, so we did a blockade along with a couple of our spouses that stood by us. We put up signs, and by Friday 12 noon they had everything loaded up, and the women followed them out. And shortly after, because of that blockade, somebody burnt down our cabin. So on May 29th, 2010, we put out a media release, and the message read, the Unistaten will not be swayed from protecting our territory from industry or government. And from that point, we decided we wanted to start setting up camps. But before that, I need to mention that the Morris River, the one I said I gave an explanation of, we were the people of the headwaters. They're proposing several pipelines through that territory. One of them is PTP, That's natural gas. And Enbridge, Kinder Morgan. I think there's two others. I can't remember them right now. But right now, we're battling PTP. At first, most of our focus was on Enbridge. But while we're spending so much time focusing on Enbridge, we didn't realize that Pacific Trails Petroleum had already got all their permits in place and already have permission to go ahead with a gas line pipeline through our territory, the exact same route as Enbridge. And when they first came around, they went to our chiefs, and a land use study had been done, and 100% of our chiefs, the Wet'suwet'en chief, said no to the PTP project. So what did PTP go and do? They turned around and went to Aboriginal bands, the band chiefs, and they went to Carrie-Sicani Tribal Council. It's a tribal office that all these bands operate under. So they went to these people and got an agreement signed. So they say they have 16 out of the 17 Aboriginal people in agreement with their project. So we heard they were having a meeting in Prince George, a contractors meeting they called. They were going to offer contracts to the Aboriginal contractors. I found out about this Thursday evening and decided I was going to take a day off work Friday. Togustin and I jumped in our car, probably 5-6 o'clock in the morning, drove all the way to Prince George, and we went to this contractors meeting, sat there. Togusta kept putting up his hand, and the people keep looking and just ignoring us, just kept bypassing us. And finally, we just stood up, and I said the very same thing that 100%, I said, 50% of your pipeline is on Wet'suwet'en territory. The Wet'suwet'en chiefs 100% said no to your project. And you turned around and went to band offices to try and say you've got consent from the Aboriginal people. And I said the Del Gamu Castellaway court case did not say band office. It did not say tribal council. It said the hereditary chief name and their house members. I said, I am here on behalf of my chief, Nnedi Bees, and I am the house member. And we said no to your project. You will not step foot on our territory. And from all these pipelines trying to threaten our territory, we started having an annual action camp. We started the first one July 14th, 2010. And we had several sponsors, and an IEN was one of our sponsors, Greenpeace, Council of Canadians. We had several different sponsors, and the first camp we had about 60 people come up, and they came from everywhere. The states, Minnesota, Chicago, Toronto, Saskatchewan, Alberta. And during this camp, we did a march down Smithers, and we stopped at every ministry office that's been giving out permits on our territory. So we did a march and had a bunch of signs. We stopped at the BC's Forest Office because of all the logging that continues to happen. And we marched down Main Street, stopped in front of Royal Bank for the purpose that they were supporting the tar sands. And we stopped in front of Ministry Environment, who issues out the permit for mining. And then we had a camp in 2011, and most of that focus was to try and create more alliances. It was a much smaller camp, and we managed to do it pretty much on our own. We didn't get any financial supports anywhere, but we decided we were going to go ahead with it anyways. And we did try to do community education because we thought it was important. They said it's fine and dandy to create alliances all around the world, but if your own community is not educated, who's going to be standing with me when I'm blocking industry? We don't want to be standing alone, This picture here is where we started practicing free, prior, informed consent. And that's where the very questions I have already been asking industry, we ask each of the camp participants who they were, why they were coming to our territory. How are you going to benefit us? The reason why we oppose the Pacific Trails pipelines, because they plan to lead the way for all other proposed pipelines. If we let one in, then they're going to say there's very little mitigation. They've already impacted the land, so it'll make it much easier for Enbridge and any of the other companies trying to come through. The route that they've planned to go through the Morse River, Gosnell Creek, is a main spawning channel for our salmon that feeds the Buckley and the Skeena. That's what we're fighting hard to protect because that's our main food source. All of our people depend on that. The bears depend on that. And the trees they're going to cut down for the pipeline, the moose and all the other animals depend on that. And I just put up some pictures. If there's the map for the Pacific Trail planned route. And then the next one shows its exact same route as the Northern Gateway Pipeline. And what Pacific Trails has done is they've lied to our people saying that pipeline is existing, it's already there. We're just going to put a bigger line in. And they're not telling the truth, it's the exact same route as the Enbridge Pipeline. This is the cabin that was constructed in 2010, and it was purposely positioned directly in line where the GPS shows the pipeline is supposed to go. And that is where our camp is. We had a third annual one this year, and the river that goes by it, everybody, you can walk up to that water and drink out a cup. It's that safe, and that's the water we're protecting. So there will be no pipelines. We want our territory to provide salmon, moose, berries, and medicines for generations to come. I don't want to be saying what used to be to my children or my grandchildren. Thank you.
That was Frieda Houston of the Wet'suwet'en Nation on First Nations activism to prevent another leaky Enbridge pipeline across northern British Columbia. The Northern Gateway Pipeline would send highly toxic tar sands crude through 1,000 mountain rivers and streams across the Great Bear Rainforest to a narrow and dangerous fjord at Kitimat, British Columbia. All that risk to feed the oil addiction of the United States and Asia from the world's largest single source of pollution, the Canadian tar sands. I'm Alex Smith with more women's voices from the event. She Speaks, Indigenous Women Speak Out Against the Tar Sands, recorded in Vancouver September 21st, 2012, by the Red Eye Collective. What can you do where you live? Listen to these ideas from the Tar Sands Network in the United Kingdom, represented by activist Suzanne Dhaliwal.
And Suzanne Dhaliwal is the co-founder of the UK Tar Sands Network, which works in solidarity with the Indigenous Environmental Network to campaign against UK corporations and financial institutions invested in the Alberta tar sands. Welcome, Suzanne.
Those are some pretty powerful voices and powerful stories, and what I'm going to tell you is a bit of my story and some of the work that has emerged from hearing these stories, hearing from these incredible, powerful women who have been leading the struggle against the world's most destructive fossil fuel. So I'll just tell you a little bit about me so you know why I'm up here. I've been a student of solidarity for about the past 11 years, working with various organisations and groups, trying to elevate the voices of Indigenous communities resisting extraction. In 2009, we happened to meet up with Heather Milton Lightning and Clayton at a climate camp that was happening in London. And there was hundreds of people who descended on a camp, and the aim was to raise awareness of what was happening with climate change. And we decided that in order to elevate those voices of people who were on the front line of the biggest climate crimes, we were going to take action. And so what that looked like was we worked with communities to develop messaging, develop banners, you know, in these camps. It was quite cold. I don't think they were expecting it to be so rainy. And the next few days meant that we took our message to the front lines of headquarters of BP and Shell, and we engaged in some pretty creative, beautiful direct action. And we went to the head of Shell, and we basically wanted them to know that we were watching that they were violating the rights of First Nations communities and that the people in the UK were not going to stand for this. And we had a pretty amazing thing happen, that suddenly we found that BBC World Service were live streaming what was happening, and that we'd actually got, you know, the world to listen, that a lot of these stories that were not getting out there, suddenly we were getting international support for them. And so we decided that we were onto something, that we could start causing quite a lot of ruckus, and that this would create a platform and a space for these voices, for these community voices and stories to be heard. So while people were in Copenhagen, we decided that we would amplify their voices by climbing up the Canadian Embassy in London and covering the Canadian flag in treacle, not oil. Safety first. And so we did a banner drop there, and what it meant was that, like I mentioned, that we could help raise the awareness of what was happening in Copenhagen and the actions that were taking place there, and to do something and to use our bodies, to use our creativity and solidarity. And so that's continued. It's gone from strength to strength. And there's a picture there of a banner that we put up, which was in Trafalgar Square, which depicts the Battle of Copenhagen. What emerged from that was the organisation UK Tar Sands Network. We decided that this relationship of solidarity was so beautiful and so strong that we needed to develop this. So we had a women's speaker tour that happened with Ariel and Heather and Melina, and in that we went to Parliament, we went to anarchist talks, we slept on the craziest floors, we went to the Centre for Alternative Technology, we connected with those transition communities. It was relentless. We really, really grilled them. But they did an amazing job, and they developed this incredible network of communities all over the UK who were ready and prized, after hearing these stories, to take action on the tar sands. The way that we've been working is that we've been taking lead and direction from the community. So as Ariel mentioned, Shell is currently being sued by the Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation. So we've been working to create a campaign that works in solidarity with that. So this is a picture of when Ariel was delivering papers to Shell in Canada. We waited with the time difference and did the same thing in London and made sure that, you know, Shell in UK knew that we were watching them and that this, you know, this was an issue that was going to plague them, that was going to bring great reputational damage to them. And It was pretty hairy. They sent like 21 vans around. We were just giving papers. I'm not doing anything. I swear this time. So that campaign has been going for a while now, and a big part of what we do is that we support communities to go into the belly of the beast, to go to the corporate AGMs of these corporations, to make sure that the shareholders, the investors, the CEO and the board hear from these communities directly, that the lies that they're telling about the sustainability of these projects, the lies that they're saying that they've actually got free, prior and informed consent from these communities, is complete hogwash. And so this was a picture taken in May, and a lot of what we do is rooted in environmental justice. So we support all the communities that are going to these AGMs and to bring together these struggles so that we can go in with a stronger voice. So we actually went to the AGM with Ariel from Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation, and our friend Ron Plain from Amjanan, and Robert, who's come down from the Arctic. And we wanted to link these struggles and use this space of coming together around the AGMs to build a stronger solidarity movement. So on the left, you can see we also had people in the UK who are resisting Shell in the Rossport community. And also the movement that's been going for a long time in the UK to shut down Shell. This is a part of the way that we work. We definitely always put forward strengthening these solidarities between the communities.
Radio EcoShock.
UK activist Suzanne Dhaliwal on anti-tar sands activism in the UK and Europe.
So another person on our hit list is BP. BP is one of the last corporations to go into the tar sands, and so we thought we were quite strategically placed to make sure that we put pressure on them again, to make sure that the investors, people who have their pensions in BP, most people in the UK have their pensions rolled up in BP, And we wanted to make sure, again, that the truth about tar sands was coming out. As Melina mentioned, there's two kinds of tar sands extraction. There's the open pit mining as well as the in situ. And BP is trying to greenwash the tar sands. They're trying to say, oh, it's not these big open pit mines, you see. It's in situ. We figured it out. Trust us. Don't trust them at all. And so we've been working, again, closely to go back every year to make sure that BP know that this isn't going away, that we're going to be on their backs until investments in tar sands is seen as completely controversial. BP is so insidious. They've really got their fingers in everything, and they've totally got their hands all on our arts at the moment. So a lot of the biggest cultural institutions and museums and galleries, our Olympics, was completely covered in BP logos. And so we've been trying to reclaim our arts a little bit. And so in the top you can see this is one of the first guerrilla ballets that happened at a BP-sponsored opera. And so we've been, you know, trying to creatively take the space and do this in a beautiful way where we try and say that, you know, the amount of money that BP are giving for arts, it's not enough, it's nothing to buy our futures, to buy our cultural spaces. And working with people like Reverend Billy, we did an exorcism of BP out of the turbine hall. An incredible look on the security guard's faces. I had no idea what to do. And in the bottom, we did this in solidarity with oil spills that had been happening here and the Gulf spill. And we had a body that was in the middle of the sculpture hall that was covered in a substance that looked like oil. And it was an incredible, stunning and incredibly moving way to get our message across. So an important thing that's coming up in the moment is the Fuel Quality Directive, which is a piece of European legislation which seeks to reduce emissions from transport emissions by 6% by 2020. It's pretty, you know, it's a soft legislation, but we're fighting hard for it because it's completely under attack by the Canadian government at the moment. This legislation would mean that tar sands would be labelled as more polluting than conventional oil, and this would send such a strong signal to the international markets to block off the European market and other markets from tar sands fuel. So what we've seen is the most unprecedented lobbying by the Canadian government in recent history. And so what we've been doing is putting pressure on our MPs to make sure that they pass this directive. We've also been getting a bit cheeky. In the top right, you can see that Gordon Campbell, you might know him. He recently took a position at the High Commissioner at the in the UK. And so we wanted to give him a UK Tar Sands Network welcome. And he was at this meeting where he was basically getting the UK government to pledge to commit to get rid of this directive, and present were heads of most oil companies and financial institutions. So we had a bit of a piece of street of theatre on the tables where we acted out an oil orgy where the UK and Canada were starting to get into bed over tar sands. So that's what we get up to. Just keep it light. And in the bottom, again, same thing, Joe Oliver giving a talk there at London School of Economics. So be rest assured, we're watching them and we're tagging them wherever they go, and we're not going to let them get away with it. So, yeah, as I mentioned at the beginning, the heart of what we do is rooted in deep solidarity with communities resisting tar sands. And so this is a group called Transition Heathrow. They stopped the expansion of the Heathrow runways on their land, and they're building a sustainable community there. And so we've had lots of beautiful visits between the communities from tar sands and on Transition Heathrow, and they've pledged to, you know, become a tar-free community. And this is just a sort of symbol and also practical way that we're starting to expand this solidarity movement.
That was UK activist Suzanne Dhaliwal from the Tar Sands Network. She's speaking against the Northern Gateway pipeline proposed by energy giant Enbridge to carry highly toxic tar sands crude. Enbridge has just revealed they had dozens of leaks in the last 2 years. I'm Alex Smith, asking you to organize however you can to make more tar sands-free communities and to stop the spread of this climate-wrecking madness. Download this and all our programs from our website at ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening and caring about your world.
reason.